This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
It's 5 Live of Oktoberfest. We're live in Hull. We're at the View Cinema in Screen 10.
Yay!
Hooray indeed. Here we come with some correspondence to do the box office top 10 reviews from Mark and some assistance here from our fine team. This from Tony, BA in English, minor in philosophy. Dear Paramedic 1 and Paramedic 2, I'm a Canadian listener living in Toronto. Love the show and never miss the podcast. In your review of Pontypool last week, you mentioned that the radio show is located in the remote town of Pontypool. This made me laugh. If it's the Pontypool I know, it's about 100 kilometres east of here and hardly remote at all. In fact, it's become commuting distance Toronto, population 3 million in recent years. Oh, and Quebecois is pronounced Quebecois and not Quebec. Oh, I can't even do it wrong now. You can be arrested here for pronouncing it the wrong way. Just thought you'd like to know that in case it ever comes up again or in case you ever visit. I haven't seen Pontypool, so it would be unfair to review it, but it's probably not very good based solely on the fact that it's Canadian. I really think hang on.
And he is Canadian,
yes.
Right?
I really think that we should give up trying to make movies because we suck at it. I can generally spot a Canadian movie within 30 seconds of watching. In fact, I can spot a Canadian movie from across a street through a living room window on a rainy night within 30 seconds. I'd be interested to know if the good doctor can name a Canadian movie that he'd watch twice.
The entire early works of David Cronenberg.
Apart from that.
What do you mean apart from that? That's like seven really great movies that all exist because of the Canadian tax base. On the subject, incidentally, of Pontypool being remote, obviously, being a film critic, I am reviewing the town or play as portrayed in the film. And in the film, it is very remote. But I'm sure in real life, it wasn't actually besieged by zombies either.
Tony says, we talk about Going Down the Road here as a Canadian classic. Have you ever seen it? It's possibly the worst film ever made.
About what?
Going Down the Road.
I don't believe I have.
It's a Canadian classic.
Is it? But it's the worst film ever made.
Yeah, according to him, anyway. Here comes the box office top 10 with added contributions. So the audience haven't seen all of them, but we'll see where we go at 10. Now, we haven't seen Blue.
Yeah, I imagine that Blue is a Bollywood movie that therefore probably wasn't normally press screened. Has anybody here seen Blue?
No, they haven't.
If anyone's seen it, send us a review, please.
Okay, so then we have Love Happens, which is this week's number 9.
Which, you know, and it is a terrible, terrible film. I'm very glad to see it slipping out of the charts as fast as it is. It does raise, as ever, the question of whether or not Jennifer Aniston is capable of making a good movie or whether there is just something about her that simply doesn't work on screen. I am inclining very heavily towards the latter position. I just think that Jennifer Aniston needs to get back to the television screen where she belongs and stay away from cinemas because she really sucks in movies.
Darren Pitt, BA Reality Studies, MA in Thrift and Personal Financial Management. Agreed, Simon and Mark, it is true that the good doctor gets carried away with impressions. Granted, the good doctor also frequently becomes breathless with the complexity of his own sentences and sounds like he's going to pass out finishing them. But these things aside, the good doctor also speaks a lot of sense, and for these reasons we love and respect him. However, a complaint.
Yeah.
I work very hard for an average wage and have to consider carefully the expenditure of my time and money. I'm not lucky enough to have a job that involves watching films and sitting around talking about them. So it was as surprising as it was ridiculous to hear Mark suggesting this week that we all go and see a film that we don't like twice. Mr. Mayor, please insist this week that A, Mr. Kummer goes and sees Love Happens for
twice.
A second time, and B, that he pays for the privilege. It is, I can assure you, not much fun having to pay to smack your face against a glass door twice.
Can I say in my defence about that, what I was saying, this is to do with the Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus, which I have seen twice, which I think is flawed. I didn't say I didn't like it. I said I think it's flawed and it's not Gilliam's best work. However, as with all of Gilliam's films, they have to be seen more than once in order to fully get the measure of them. It may therefore be the answer that, in fact, to fully appreciate any Terry Gilliam film, you have to own it on DVD and watch it more than once. Why any household would be without the entire collected works of Terry Gilliam on DVD is frankly beyond me. But I mean, I'm assuming that everybody here owns all of Terry Gilliam's films on DVD.
Right, well, can you put your hand up if you own all of those works?
There we go.
One, two, three.
My people.
Four. That's it. Four out of 300.
Put your hand up if any of the people who put their hands up are married. There we go, you see?
You are unique. Halloween 2's at number 8.
Well, you know, as we've discussed before, the ongoing rehashing of the Halloween saga has nothing to add. I mean, luckily, I was off with swine flu that fantastic week.
Yes, what an excuse that was.
Yeah, and somebody's been twittering saying, oh, incidentally, has Dr. Kermode seen that apparently the swine flu that's going around at the moment is incredibly mild and nothing to be upset about at all? Well, thanks for that sympathy.
Triangle's at number 7.
I really like Triangle very much. It's a really sort of well put together, intelligent movie. It's a sort of quantum leap for the director. It's got a time loop structure which works very well. It's made for a fairly tight budget. It's a film which is dominated by a good script and solid performances. It has moments of genuine scares in it, and again, is worth seeing more than once just to see how all the pieces, you know, fit together. It's really great to see a movie like that, which is so well written.
Here's another opinion on Triangle. Yes, sir. What's your name?
Ian.
Ian, where are you from?
Falkirk.
Have you come from Falkirk just for the show?
Not just for the show. I came down for this weekend managed to get a ticket for the show when I was down here.
Well, you're very welcome. What do you think of Triangle?
Groundhog Day with blood.
But you say that as if it's a bad thing. You mean that as a good thing, right?
I want to see it again to see if I can find all the little bits which you've been talking about.
There we go. You see, I love that. See, somebody who thinks the movie didn't quite work the first time, solution, go see it again.
Fame is at number 6.
Well, why on earth the Fame remake should exist at all is something of a question. I mean, when I saw it, I thought whatever edge the original Fame had been taken off it in the remake. That said, I know a couple of kids who've been to see it and enjoyed it very much. So it is incredibly sort of prepackaged and, you know, turned into an even more rounded thing than it was before, but apparently it's working for the target audience.
At the back, sir, what's your name?
James. My 12-year-old daughter enjoyed it a lot. But the only bit I did enjoy was the bit where they all started getting up and playing the drums and messing about in the cafeteria.
Yeah, that was the moment at which I nearly gnawed my hand off, because that actually, because even the first time round, the thing my daughter really liked this new version as well. Even in the first version, the point I always had a problem with was the bit when they're so excited about being talented that they go out onto the streets and do that. And I thought, you know, if they update it, they're not possibly going to do that again. But they do. The difference is this time, it's a bit hip hop. You know, so they go, doom, doo, doo, oh, I'm so excited about being touted. Yo, I'm going to go out. That really bothered me.
You're watching that online. That was truly an extraordinary sequence, indeed. Zombieland at number 5. We have some people who've seen that. Mark, you go first.
Well, I like it very much. I mean, you know that there was a problem on the show because this was the week that I was off with swine flu. Thanks for the sympathy. Floyd and Boyd did between them actually reveal the cameo, which I imagine everybody now knows the cameo. But if you don't, and if you haven't seen Zombieland, if you haven't had the spoiler about who the cameo is, go and see it, because when the cameo turns up, it is funny.
Posters and indeed ads for that film that say, come see Zombieland starring...
Oh, really? Indeed. Oh, well, in that case, they have no one but themselves to blame.
Yes, so what's your name?
Neil.
Hello,
I'm
Neil.
Leon C.
From Leon C. You just come for the show?
Yeah.
You're very welcome. So what did you think of Zombieland?
Not as good as Shaun of the Dead, but the cameo is a legend.
Yeah, it isn't as good as Shaun of the Dead. And the most extraordinary thing about Shaun of the Dead, and I think I said this last week, is that as time passes, that movie looks even better. And I do think, although at the time I liked it, but I didn't have any sense of just how good it was, I do think it has now become something of a modern classic. It's really, really well put together. And it's funny how when you see something like Zombieland, which I think is a perfectly good, jolly romp, you go, yeah, but it ain't Shaun of the Dead. And it makes you realise just how smart and just how intelligent and just how much in the genre Shaun of the Dead was. I think it's a very... I really like that movie. I like it more as time passes.
The Invention of Lying at number 4.
You want me?
No, you go first. Well,
it's not Ricky Gervais's finest hour by a million miles. And the interesting thing is that Ghost Town was a much better film. There's an idea at the centre of Invention of Lying. I think it had 4.5, 5 laughs. We were arguing about how many titters constitute a laugh. But it's nothing like as funny as it needs to be to sustain the high concept gag.
Yeah, so what's your name?
Greg.
And where are you from, Greg?
Tottenham, North London.
Thanks for making up the journey from that hallowed and famous part.
I live right near the Spurs ground.
Ah. Who do you support?
I'm a basketball fan.
Oh.
Hey!
How disappointing. You led me up the garden path and you did it on purpose. What did you think of The Invention of Lying?
I'm a big Ricky Gervais fan. I just didn't think it was funny at all. It's intelligent, interesting premise, but his act is wearing quite thin.
Thank you very much indeed. Number 3, new entry, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Which, you know, as we've said before, you need to go and see twice, obviously, to appreciate it. I mean, the extraordinary thing about it is that considering the terrible production problem that they had with the fact that Heath Ledger, the leading man, died halfway through the production, it's amazing that that's not the thing that is the problem with the film. In fact, the using other actors to fill his role works surprisingly well. And frankly, I would go and see any Gilliam film because I think he's a proper filmmaker. He's somebody who's got a vision and is interested in making cinema that isn't just a matter of, you know, making the numbers add up. The only film of his that I found genuinely disappointing was Brothers Grimm.
Right at the back, sir, what's your name?
John.
Hi, John, where are you from?
Chesterfield in Derbyshire.
And what did you make of The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus?
I enjoyed it. I echo most of what Mark said. First Terry Gilliam film I've seen, so I wasn't sure what to expect.
First ever?
Yeah.
So you haven't seen Brazil, you haven't seen 12 Monkeys?
No, I've recorded those recently on TV to watch, but I will go back and see it again some point in the future. The thing that did impress me, though, was knowing the production problems there with Heath Ledger's death, watching it for the first time, not looking for flaws, just watching the film generally, the editing was very good because you couldn't really tell that Heath Ledger had died halfway through. And it almost came across as though the idea of using the other actor was inspired, not as a fill-in, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely right. And it's interesting hearing Terry Gilliam talking about it, is that he's kind of always shied away from saying, you know, in an odd way, it gave them something that they wouldn't have had otherwise, but it does look like it was done deliberately. Can I just say, incidentally, if you haven't seen yet and you've got on tape things like Brazil and 12 Monkeys, you've got a wonderful period ahead of you seeing those films for the first time. I mean, honestly, it's...
Just one quick point, because I know you're pressed for time, is what did surprise me, knowing the bits I've read about Gilliam in other films, is the ending, without giving away from anybody, surprised me because I didn't think I'd end up seeing that sort of ending, really.
Yeah, Gilliam is always surprising, and you should never, you know, you should never prejudge him, but wait until you get to the end of Brazil. That will surprise you. Actually, it depends which version of Brazil you're watching, but if you're watching if you watch Brazil and at the end you're happy, you're watching the wrong version.
Rob Perkins in Wellingborough, Dick Cardboard and Cut Out. A friend and I went to see The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus this week. On balance, I really enjoyed it. The tone of the first half was really dark and brooding, and the good doctor is right to say that the Ledger et al. Performances were very well managed. All the main performances were excellent as well. However, the problems with the film emerged at about the point when Colin Farrell shows up. Usually this is because of the aforementioned Scruffy Blotch himself, but he was not at fault in this film
Scruffy
in general.
Blotch.
The film lost both its mood and its plot at the same point. It's a shame because it would have been one of the best Gilliam films if it had kept the uneasiness of the first hour.
Okay, I mean, I think that idea that there are things in it that are really good, but it in itself is not a complete coherent whole, is true.
Couples Retreat is this week's number two. Mark goes first.
I mean, you know, Vince Vaughn, it's a terrifying thing that you look back on, you know, Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau and think, oh, I remember seeing Swingers and thinking, wow, they're really great and really funny and really snappy and really sassy. And then over the years, just watching them, you know, just fall into this incredibly boring, bland, middle-of-the-road Hollywood stodge. And I just thought Couples Retreat was yet another one of those movies that makes you wonder whatever happened to the Vince Vaughn that, you know, we once wanted to embrace. I mean, nowadays, you couldn't get your arms around him anyway.
Yes, sir. What's your name?
Joe.
Where are you from, Joe?
Well, I've come straight from the LFF, but I'm from Nottingham at the moment.
Very good to have you here. What did you think of Couples Retreat?
I'd just like to qualify this by saying I try and see as many films as possible because you can't appreciate the good ones without seeing the truly terrible ones.
Absolutely.
And it just is so depressing seeing two clearly talented people, and they surrounded themselves with a great cast with Jason Bateman and Marlon Akerman, and they come out with something so bad.
Jason Bateman is actually the real disappointment because he is still kind of edgy and interesting, and he's still, when you expect that he will do interesting things from now on. I think as far as Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau is concerned, it's just all over, isn't it?
I think after seeing that and the breakup, which are the last two that I can think that they starred in together, that directing maybe for Jon Favreau and just dieting for Vince Vaughn.
Let's get that. That's very good advice. We'll get some comments on Up in just a minute. You put your hand up if you have seen Up. We'll get three or four comments on that, as it is the UK's number one film. A listener, first of all, Mark from Helston in Cornwall. Dear Clunk and Zilly, I took my six-year-old daughter and partner to see Up last week. Thought it was the best animated feature I'd seen in yonks. Bearing in mind it was officially a kiddie flick, I was totally unprepared for the opening 10 minutes, which I felt were handled brilliantly. Yep. And then, for a further onslaught on my emotions towards the latter end when the film, when Carl revisits his and Ellie's scrapbook. A word of warning to half-sensitive parents who are thinking of taking their young offspring. It was during the second, shall we say, sad event in the movie that my daughter leant across my seat looking closely at me and inquiring rather loudly, as only a child can, "Daddy, what's wrong with your eyes?" I whispered that I thought something had flown into them, and for her to shush. My daughter was by then almost on top of me, trying to see into my eyes in the dim light. She then turned and exclaimed loudly and proudly to my partner that, "Hey, guess what? I think Dad is crying. He is, honestly." You can imagine my acute embarrassment as the two rows of people in front of us turned round to check the soft lad out. Good film, as I've said, had me thinking about it for a day or so.
I think the opening 10 minutes are extraordinary, and I think the moment when we get to the scrapbook, what you described as the second unhappy event, is very, very well done. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it's perfect in the way that Toy Story was perfect, or the way that Mary Poppins is perfect. But I think it's very good. I think it needs to be slightly more disciplined. I think flat screen 2D experience of it is perfectly fine, and I think it's definitely at the upper end of what animation can be doing. I was just not quite as wowed by it as everybody else, but partly because the opening 10 minutes was so good that I kind of felt the rest of the movie had a hard job living up to just how good they were.
Okay, let's get some comments on up. Yes, so what's your name?
Josh Owen.
Where are you from, Josh?
Bristol.
What do you think?
I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I've grown up with Disney Pixar, and I think it's a fantastic, fantastic film. And incidentally, I think in contrast with DreamWorks, who have been relatively poor, and I think you've been incredibly kind to actually, Mark.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think DreamWorks have made some interesting films, and I think that the ongoing alleged rivalry between Pixar, Disney, and DreamWorks is often sort of misplaced, because I think the product is more scattershot than people think. I mean, I think, for example, Pixar have dropped the ball sometimes. I remain to be convinced that The Incredibles is the great movie that everybody says it is. I still think there are fundamental problems with it. But in terms of track record, it's undoubtedly true that Pixar have revolutionized the way that animation exists nowadays. And I think the hero of all of this is John Lasseter. I think John Lasseter is genuinely a genius.
Gentleman in the leather jacket. Yes, so what's your name?
Andy from Southmeers to in Essex.
And what do you think, Andy?
It was the first, because the first 10 minutes, I took my 8-year-old son last time. Yeah. It was the first Pixar film that for the first 10 minutes he didn't quite get.
Yeah.
And it was a lot more grown up than a lot of the others. And I really enjoyed it. And yeah, I cried. But he sort of sat there and, well, what's going on? Which was different for Pixar. Yeah.
Further back, gentlemen, yes, sir. What's your name?
It's James.
Hi, James, where are you from?
Nuneaton.
What do you think of Up?
I thought it was fantastic. Peer pressure meant that I had to go and see it in 3D, but the only thing that came out of that was I got to have cool Buddy Holly glasses. But yeah, I thought that.
How much did you have to pay?
A lot more than, well, we did the Wednesday cheap thing, but yeah, a lot more than normal. And you don't get money off if you take them back again. Which is
apparently there are some cinemas that are starting to say, that. If you bring your own glasses, it'll be a couple of quid cheaper. But that's only happening in a few cinemas.
No, that's right. I mean, I know this from people twittering about it. Apparently there are certain cinemas that are doing that, and good for them, because that is the way it should be. You shouldn't have to pay extra to see a film in 3D.
That's the box office top 10. We'll get to what's the first movie?
Fantastic Mr. Fox. Which you've seen as well.
Text on 85058. We're asking for some help on Blue.
Blue.
Who is this? It's Mr. T in Harrow. Hi, real doc and not so real doc. Blue is so awful, so cringeworthy, especially Kylie Minogue's cameo. She's in it.
Wow.
The director's more focused on the lead female's bikini bottoms rather than directing the movie. I had to break my film constitution. I had to leave at the intermission. I agree. Well, it's a film with an intermission. How about that? I agree with Dr. K's review of Triangle. I love the film Blue. That's from Sam White. Who's in the audience? Who clearly, when we asked, is there anyone in the audience who'd seen Blue?
Didn't put his hand up, but reached for his phone.
Where is Sam White? All right, Sam.
A friend watching on the computer, and he thought that was hilarious.
He thought that was fun. Okay. Thanks for your review. Imran in Accrington. Blue is a copy of the Alba film Into the Blue and has a cameo by Kylie, and it's rubbish. Says
there we go.
Thanks for the comments.
Didn't
on
miss
that
much, then.
Fantastic Mr. Fox is the most high profile movie release of the week.
So, obviously coming up to half term, and this, I suppose, therefore, is the big half term release. It's based on the Roald Dahl book, although it's a Wes Anderson movie. And I think, for my money, it's more a Wes Anderson than a Roald Dahl story. It's done in stop motion animation and is theoretically, therefore, Wes Anderson's animation debut. Although there is some animation in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Because you remember, you and I saw that together, and there are those animated bits in the middle, and I laughed all the way through them, and you sat absolutely stone-faced.
I think I laughed twice.
Yeah, you laughed twice. I laughed a lot more. I like that film, although I do find a little bit of Wes Anderson goes an awfully long way. So we'll play a clip first. You probably know that the voice cast is incredibly star-studded. It includes George Clooney, Meryl Streep, Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray, who we shan't speak of in relation to other movies that he's in, and, of course, a cameo by Jarvis Cocker, which which we shall come to in a moment. But here is an example of what The Fantastic Mr. Fox, as retold by Wes Anderson and co, sounds like.
Does anybody actually read my column? Do your friends ever talk about it?
Of course. In fact, Rabbit's ex-girlfriend just said to me last week, I should read Foxy's column, but they don't get the Gazette. Ash, let's get cracking.
Why would they? It's a rag sheet.
I'm sick.
You're not sick.
I have a temperature.
You don't have a temperature.
I don't want to go.
Hurry up, you're going to be late.
I love the way you handle that.
Your cousin Christofferson's coming on the 6th. I want you to be extra nice to him, because he's going through a very hard time right now.
Where's he
going to
sleep?
We're going to make a bed for him in your room.
I can't spare the space. Put him in Dad's study.
Dad's study is occupied by Dad. I don't want to live in a hole anymore. It makes me feel poor.
We are poor, but we're happy.
Comme ci, comme ça. Anyway, the views are better above ground. Honey, I'm 7 non-Fox years old now. My father died at 7 and a half. I don't want to live in a hole anymore, and I'm going to do something about it.
Now, I'm sorry. Is it just me, or does that just sound like a Wes Anderson movie that is not in any way an animated kids movie? Comme ci, comme ça. When was the last time somebody said that in a kids movie? My problem with it is this. I think stop-motion animation itself is a wonderful thing, and particularly in an age in which everything has gone CG and digimation, I think it's really great that people are doing stop-motion. And there is a visual beauty to stop-motion that is pretty much unmatched by any other genre. And you only have to look at the work of Nick Park and Aardman to understand just how good that can be when it's done. But if you compare Fantastic Mr. Fox to the work of Nick Park and Aardman, you realize that what Aardman do that is so brilliant is, firstly, they understand entirely what a genuine family film means. They mean a film in which the jokes will work whether you are 7 or 70, that will genuinely work across the ages, not that you have characters that are animated so you think, well, the kids are looking at the animated characters but the voices are talking like George Clooney and Meryl Streep and talking in that incredibly sort of introverted, navel-gazing, you know, academic, self-obsessed way in which that so many Wes Anderson films do. If, I mean, if what you want is the Royal Tenenbaums done as an animated Fox feature, then fine, but you're clearly wanting that from a grown-up point of view. For me, the problem with The Fantastic Mr. Fox is it's not a family film or a kids film. It's a film that's made by a bunch of adults sitting around, you know, with a glass of red wine and a copy of, you know, intellectual publication. Saying,
Time Out in the Guardian, I'd suggest.
Time Out in the Guardian, yes, but not Fangoria. And saying, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if we made a film that looked like a kids film, but obviously wasn't a kids film. And I think what they've demonstrated in this is just how brilliant things like Wallace and Gromit are. Because in, for example, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, there is a film which hits every single mark, which, if you are 3 years old, you understand why it's funny. Firstly, because they really understand visual humor. The sequence in Curse of the Were-Rabbit, in which Gromit is activating the huge Were-Rabbit puppet, which is just like a Charlie Chaplin sequence or a Buster Keaton sequence. It's beautiful, silent comedy, right? The problem with Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox is it doesn't know when to stop talking. It's an incredibly talky film. It's a film in which they talk incessantly. And they talk incessantly. I know you're looking at me like, how dare you criticize people.
A thought had occurred to me.
And if I can just dig myself into an even deeper hole than that, it is a film in which, while I'm watching it, the word which comes to mind most of all is smug. So it is. Here am I criticizing a film for being overly talky and smug. But essentially, therefore, it's like watching me on screen, and imagine how annoying that would be if I was an animated fox. And the problem with it is that when you do this sort of thing, if what you're genuinely attempting to do is to hit the widest possible audience, you should be veering towards Dahl, because the genius of Dahl is that he was dark and, you know, he had, you know, dark subject matter, but he told those stories in a way that, in the tradition of the Grimm's fairy tales, he understood that darkness and light are essentially part of what makes something accessible to kids and adults alike. What you have here is him going, well, let's just make it a Wes Anderson movie. And I really don't think that kids are going to sit there through a talky Wes Anderson movie and get it in the way that they ought to. And it's not a failing of the kids' point, it's a failing of the film. The film is too talky, too full of itself, too smug, too determined to drag everything into Wes Anderson's. And it's funny, reading the reviews of it, I mean, there have been some incredibly reverential reviews, all written by middle-aged people who like Wes Anderson movies. And I have yet to see somebody, like an 8-year-old or a 7-year-old. So I saw that Fantastic Mr. Fox, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And I really loved the bit when George Clooney did the joke about existentialism.
I suspect that most people will enjoy it slightly more than you did.
I did.
The Wes Anderson thing has irritated you a lot, but it looks stunning, and the soundtrack, all banjos and burlives, as I think I might have mentioned before,
yes,
does make it fun.
Well, I think, again, the Jarvis Cocker song is pretty much an example of what's wrong, because there's a section in it in which Jarvis Cocker turns up.
Jarvis was on the show yesterday.
I know he was. Yeah. I listened to him, yes, and I was shouting at the radio. And he turns up as Jarvis Cocker, and he plays a banjo song, right? And this is a hilarious gag if you're old enough to know who Jarvis Cocker is, and if you're old enough to understand that, you know, his back catalogue. If you're a kid, it's just somebody playing. And the funny thing about is that he plays this song, and at the end of it, the gag is that one of the characters says, "Pete, that's just bad songwriting." And I was the guy in the audience going, "Yep, that was exactly what that was. It was just bad songwriting."
Daniel on this email, "Dear Maxwell and his Silver Hammer, Fantastic Mr. Fox is one of my favourite childhood books, and recently listened to the audiobook version read by Roald Dahl himself. Imagine my disappointment when I saw the trailer for the new adaptation." So this email is just based on watching the trailer, which we've been running here in the cinema. "I'm a big fan of Bill Murray and quite like George Clooney, but the trailer seems to have taken Dahl's wonderfully dark, ribald tale and turned it into a catchphrase-ridden, dumb and gimmicky action film. Haven't seen the film, so I went entirely past judgment." I think you have, Daniel. "But it looks like a subpar Wind in the Willows. One wishes that Henry Selick had made it instead." Martin, "Dear Bart and Wacko, so the Fantastic Mr. Fox, alliterative is the title, and thus so must be the review. Does Mark find it to be veritably a valuably viewable, variable, or vexatiously vacuous videographic vulpine venture?" Vulpine, of course, meaning resembling or
I know characteristic what vulpine means.
I'm just reading from the email for those who don't.
Okay. How many people here knew what vulpine meant? There you go.
Okay, overwhelmingly the majority didn't. So when you say, I love it when you ask for a vote and go, "There you are." Is it? Yes, but it proved the opposite. You were using your Iranian electioneer counting system again. "Oh, look, I appear to have lost. Let's just say I've won that."
Yes.
Has anyone seen Fantastic Mr. Fox, by the way? It's only been out right at the back. Oh, look, there's a microphone right by you. Who are you?
I'm Ash from Ponte.
Hello,
Ash. I went to London Film Festival to watch with college, and I fell asleep in it. All of my classmates hated it, other than my teacher.
Absolutely agree. The classmates hated it, but the teacher, "Oh, yes, this must be brilliant, it must be marvellous. They're all talking really fast and talking about New York subjects. That must be very clever." That's exactly it.
Anyone? Oh, it's a gentleman here who was also at the London Film Festival, so that's why he's been able to see it. Yes, sir. We'll get that microphone to you. Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but would you suggest that the problem isn't with the film itself, because if it was just a Wes Anderson film, he makes brilliant films.
He sometimes makes brilliant films, but he sometimes makes films that are completely full of themselves.
But is the problem with the film itself, or is it in the fact that it's been made and marketed towards kids and coming out at half term? If this was coming out the week before the Oscars, you have had such a problem with it, do you
Yes,
think?
Because it's an adaptation of The Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is a family tale for all of them. If, for example, Danny said, I've really gone out of my way to make this completely inaccessible to children. I've made it only, you know, accessible to 45. But that's not what they're saying. It is attempting to... I mean, the really strange thing about it is that Wes Anderson clearly is in love with the Roald Dahl. He says it's the first book he ever owned. He spent time, you know, in the place where it was written. I mean, he's really done all that research.
I mean, I love the book, and I am quite nervous going into watching it, but I think probably the place for it looks like the London Film Festival rather than Half Term Week.
Well, I would think that that's true.
Quick comment from the gentleman next to you, then we'll have to take some news and sport. We'll be back for more in just a moment. Yes, sir.
I also haven't seen it.
let's fill a half hour with people who haven't seen it, but they think they might know what they're going to think.
However, it was a book I used to read from cover to cover in one sitting as a child, and It was dark, and there was a feeling of desperation about the whole thing.
Yes.
So would Tim Burton not have been better?
So we have some emails here, and if you have, by the way, seen Fantastic Mr. Fox, I know it's early days, but if you've seen it and maybe taken someone who's under 12 to see it, sure. if you could email us before the end of the programme, it would be interesting to see whether indeed your theory has held up. This is from Hashim, BA Honours film student. So, The Fantastic Mr. Fox, he says, isn't really meant to be a kid's movie. It just happens to be rated PG. I really don't think family was the target audience for this film. So, with this in mind, is it good or just bad anyway?
Well, I think family was the target audience. It's an adaptation of Fantastic Mr. Fox. I mean, they can say as many times as they want, oh, well, actually, it's for a more grown-up audience. You know, that's not a good enough answer. All you need to do is put it next to The Curse of the Were-Rabbit and go, there you go, that is a brilliant stop-motion animation that everyone can enjoy. And this is a film that Wes Anderson and his friends can be smug about.
Dear Agent Johnson and Agent Johnson, this is Toby on the W12 and possibly, it might be M12. Anyway, maybe it's Archway. Anyway, he says, to follow up on Simon's point about the end of The Men Who Stare at Goats, which we were talking about recently. Yeah. I have to disagree with the not real Doctor. I took the ending as a simple sight gag, a clever bookend to be mirrored with the opening scene with the Major General and part of a mainly comic movie. As an aside, coming out of the film festival, this is the LFF again, screening for The Road, powerful stuff from director and stars alike, faithful to a book that I think they did a great job of bringing to the screen. I was queuing to get out next to Jason Isaacs. It was all I could do not to blurt out hello to Jason Isaacs, and thankfully I controlled myself. But he doesn't mind it. I mean, if you see him in the street, he quite likes it.
Apparently he does. Apparently if people go up to him and say hello, he's very thrilled. So I would encourage everybody to do it, and that will now make his life a nightmare.
Should we get everyone to do that?
Should we all say hello to Jason Isaacs?
There was a fantastic scene a couple of weeks ago, I am led to believe, where Jason Isaacs was in full Lucius Malfoy gear, mask, Death Eater mask and everything else, listening to the programme, as indeed we said hello to him. So that was an extraordinary Death Eater moment, I think.
It was. Shall we all do it?
Yes. So if you could say hello to Jason Isaacs, just because he would like to hear from Hull.
After three, one, two, three.
Hello, Jason Isaacs.
I think that was a bit limp, really. And hello to David Morrissey. Getting limper.
This is like the life of Brian, isn't it?
Shall we try Fairport Convention?
Hello.
Let's say hello to Mitch Benn. We're gearing up to his big song, by the way. He's taken all the strands that you suggested, and that's how we'll be concluding our programme today. What else is new, Mark?
Look, I want to get to the Cove, but since we've got a very brief period before the travel, I'm going to see if I can do this. This is the goods, right? This is a new comedy movie, and I use the word advisedly, from the Will Ferrell stable, starring Jeremy Piven, who's I mention now because he's apparently a star of Entourage, in which Jason Isaacs featured. And this is, you know, it's yet another of those films in which it's, just grotesquely lowbrow, stupid, barrel scraping garbage, but does that thing that all those lowbrow, stupid barrel scraping garbage comedies do, which is at the end they pretend that they actually have to be about something else and have a redeeming moment. And I want to see whether it's actually possible to review a movie entirely from the production notes. Listen to this, all right? This is the description of the movie. These things are all taken directly from the production notes. So it starts off by saying, the new comedy from the makers of Talladega Nights and Step Brothers, raunchy, risque, and politically incorrect, The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard, is a 500 horsepower ride through a 3-day car sale. Okay? So it's a comedy about selling cars. Okay? So now, Mr. Mackay, who's one of the producers, says he and his partners are in the enviable position of being able to work on a movie just because we think it's funny. If it makes us laugh, then we want to do it. Over the page, he's the first to admit that he likes to take a joke as far as it can go. And we've certainly done that, he says. But then here, listen to this. This is my favourite moment in the whole thing. The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard, says Mackay, is a great movie to see with both friends and to laugh your butt off. But there's also something more lying beneath the surface. This is The Goods, remember? Sometimes a movie can transcend the simple form it takes. I don't want to say that I hope this movie changes nations, but maybe out of the hundreds of thousands of people who fill the movie theatres, 100 to 150 of them will go through a little change of heart and walk out with a broader view of the world. The worst thing about it is, I don't know whether that's meant to be a joke, because the film itself is so witless, so headache-inducingly stupid, so, oh, blimey, why am I having to do this? You know, I talked before about watching a movie as being like running into a glass door, right? It's so thunderingly unfunny that even if that is a piece of high satire that is apparently taking the mick out of itself, it's unrecognisable as such. It is made by people who clearly have had all their funny bones medically taken out of their bodies. And watching it, it was that thing that, I don't know whether any of you have ever had this, you're watching a comedy that starts out being, oh yeah, these guys are brash and all the rest of it, but you know there's got to be a life change. And you start to feel yourself petrify from the feet upwards. And as the film goes on, bits of your body stop working. And you think, is it pins and needles? You think, no, I am actually petrifying as I'm sitting here. By the time I got to the end of it, it was just creeping right up. I was essentially like that in the chair. A couple of people walked out, but I couldn't get up.
You were turning to stone.
Yeah, but have you never had that when you're sitting there watching a movie and you think, this is bad, this is really bad, this is blimey, O'Reilly, this is really bad. And it's like your body has gone, I don't want to be here. And it switched. Have you never had that?
Nope.
Has anyone ever had that experience of watching
turned
a movie
to stone while watching
so a stupefyingly bad that you actually turned to stone?
Okay, there's a man with his hand up. What was the film, sir? Pardon? You had your hand up. When Mark asked, he said, has anyone else had this experience? There was a hand up. Who was it?
Oh, they've stayed.
Hello?
Petrified, yes.
Yes. Yes.
Not at a film, but certainly that feeling.
You know that feeling. Not at a film, though. Right. Just one other comment just down the front here, just because you're very close to the microphone.
Tropic Thunder. It's a terrible movie.
Ah, no, you see, I'd fight you on that.
Funny.
I don't think Tropic Thunder is a terrible film. I think that what there is in Tropic Thunder is a good low-budget comedy that has been weighed down by $100,000, you know, dollars, and therefore has been turned into something that's so big and bloated that it's not funny anymore. If they'd made that movie for a quarter of the budget, it would have been funny, because there are individual things in it that are funny.
It's only funny when the director blows up.
The Steve Coogan director.
Yeah, that's
about 15 minutes into the film. And then after they say, no, I thought there were individual bits beyond that that were funny, but the budget was, you know, was just too much. Anyway,
what's next?
The Cove is this, you may have seen the posters for it. It's a documentary. It's a very, very dramatic documentary. It's a story about the capturing and killing and culling of dolphins in Taiji. And it centers around this central character, Rick O'Barry, who was formerly the trainer for Flipper, you know, Flipper from the TV series. And it's a very, very interesting piece of work, because one of the things about documentaries, particularly eco-documentaries or campaigning documentaries, they often run the risk of being sort of boring or sanctimonious or self-righteous, and therefore being, whilst, you know, laudable, somehow dramatically uninvolving. And I mean, I know everybody else likes it more than I do, but I think that incredibly boring, you know, and unfortunate truth was like... You know, I remember seeing that at Cannes. I was there.
Is that the same as The Inconvenient Truth?
It was a sequel that you didn't see. Yeah. And in fact, no, I saw it at Cannes, and he got up and he introduced the movie. And, you know, what's his name?
Al Gore.
Al Gore. And he stood up and he started literally by the... He was halfway through the introduction, I was asleep. Anyway, so in the story of The Cove, you have this guy, Rick O'Barry, who was the trainer of Flipper. And he talks on camera about having this bizarre Pauline moment in which he realized that the dolphins that he was looking after in captivity were incredibly depressed. And he talks about one of them, who was the key Flipper dolphin, committing suicide in his arms. And it sounds like a really strange, absurdist thing. He says that the dolphin came into his arms and died in his arms. And he describes it as suicidal despair. And you think this is a very, very peculiar thing to say. But it's the beginning of his journey. He suddenly decided that what he wanted to do for the rest of his life was to fight for and free dolphins. There is an annual thing that happens in this cove, Taiji, in which what happens is a group of dolphins are rounded up into a cove, and some of them are taken off to be used as exhibit dolphins, and the rest are killed and are used for dolphin meat, which it turns out there's a staggering amount of dolphin meat sold, often under different guises, not sold as dolphin meat, and it turns out that there's a massive amount of mercury poisoning in dolphin meat. So it sounds like a very, very difficult, hard, you know, tough sell. In fact, what you have is a documentary which is not only very important because it's a story about if this story gets out into the world, it's very possible that what's happening there at the moment might actually stop happening. But it's a documentary which is dramatic, engaging, involving, surprising, sometimes funny, but for a great proportion of it is almost like a spy movie, because what they do is, in order to expose this, a team of them get together and go to this cove where you're not allowed to go with cameras in hidden rocks and underwater, you know, photography equipment, and they go effectively on a special ops raid to reveal what's happening in the cove. Anyway, here's a quick clip of the documentary. Here we go.
I spent 10 years building that industry up, and I spent the last 35 years trying to tear it down. When I started out, there were only 3 dolphinariums. Today, it's become a multi-billion dollar industry. And all of these captures. He helped create the largest slaughter of dolphins on the planet.
Anyone can watch the capture process go on from the road. But Rick pointed out where they take the boats around to the secret cove that nobody could see, where dolphins that weren't selected are slaughtered and sold for their meat.
Now, the extraordinary thing about the documentary is that because of the way it's filmed, it's incredibly cinematic. The story is really gripping. I mean, there are moments in it when it almost plays like a Mission Impossible movie. It's got night vision. It's, you know, people dressed in, you know, all in black, putting secret cameras around the thing. They're up against the authorities. They're threatened with arrest. They're sort of, they're, wherever they go, they're effectively being hounded by the authorities. And it's a real edge of your seat ride. It has an ending which is quite extraordinary, which is described in a review by Trevor Johnson, who I think is a brilliant film critic, as being positively Shakespearean. And I can't remember the last time that I genuinely thought that about a documentary, because it is like that. It is positively Shakespearean. And despite the fact that an awful lot of the time, many documentaries probably don't, perhaps aren't best served by being in the cinema arena, The Cove is definitely something that is a cinematic experience. It's a traumatic experience. It's a brilliantly put together film. It has a very simple and very clear message, which is if people knew this was happening, it would probably stop happening. It's a great conspiracy thriller about the way in which this whole story is being covered up. And I would heartily recommend it to anybody who is interested either in cinema or in dolphins or even in action adventure, because I'm not kidding. This thing plays for a lot of it like some kind of spy thriller and a Shakespearean tragedy all rolled into one. It is really fine piece of work.
Now, here's the first email, specifically after what you wanted. Mark, just had 2.5 minutes. Is Chris in Oxford. Dear Fantastic Planet and Fantastic Voyage. Saw Fantastic Mr. Fox last night at a preview screening in Oxford. Lots of parents and children, many of whom waited with eager anticipation for what they presumed would be a faithful adaptation of a beloved childhood favourite. Whilst I, as an elder, enjoyed the dry, ironic Wes Anderson-esque dialogue.
That's dry, ironic. That's the phrase, isn't it?
May I continue?
Sorry. So it's just like, if it's like chalk on a blackboard, dry, ironic.
And sporadically entertaining animation, there was barely any reaction from the children in the audience. No great laughs, no great charm, no great wonder. A disappointing souffle of a film which seemed to have collapsed under the weight of its own overwhipped smugness and longueurs. Chris Knight in Oxford.
Very good.
How about that?
You should get Chris Knight in Oxford on next time I'm off, because I couldn't have put it better. In fact, I didn't put it that well. He put it rather better than I did.
Is there anything else that should be chucked in our remaining 70 seconds?
In the remaining 70 seconds, we should say, in the subject of Colin, which is a zombie movie allegedly made for £45. I mean, it's
fine as long as everyone works for no money.
Yes, and you have all the camera and editing equipment. So, I mean, there are some interesting things in there, and it's a good calling card for the director. I mean, it's the best movie for £45 that I've seen for quite a long time, and I have seen many films that cost much more than that have less invention. There are certain moments in it that suggest that later on, Mark Price will go on to make some proper interesting films. This itself is a calling card. I think basically it found its home at Fright Fest. It's going to be out on DVD very soon. There is a very, very good film, although it be a tough film, if you're up for it. There's a film about child soldiers, which is shot in Liberia, although it's not. It doesn't say that's where it is. It's called Johnny Mad Dog, and it is an extraordinary film about child soldiers. It's a drama, but it has great sort of documentary. And I thought it was like a cross between a Clockwork Orange and some water. Anyway, Johnny Mad Dog, if you get a chance.
Film of the week.
Well, The Cove, actually.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.